Welcome to Emphasis Added, a podcast by the Houston Law Review, where we highlight legal issues with prominent lawyers and discuss the study and practice of law. I'm your host, Kevin Donovan. Welcome to the Law School Real Talk series with the Houston Law Review, where current law students share their experience and advice on how to navigate your first year in law school. I'm joined today by Kirsten Williams and Drew McKay, and we're going to be talking about Legal Recruiting 101 and how to get your dream law job. So, welcome to the show, Drew and Kirsten.
Thanks, Kevin. Happy to be here.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you. And so, I want to start it off with just kind of talking about you all's experience with legal recruiting and your internships, and then where you're going to go post law school. So, I'd love to hear where were you last summer, or even the summer before, and where do you plan on going when you graduate?
So I'll start off. So the first summer after 1L, I was in the appellate division at the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I was doing a lot of writing. That was a great internship for writing. And the second summer, last summer, I was at the Office of Immigration Litigation in Washington, D.C., which is under the Department of Justice. And that was, that's a mouthful there, but what you're doing is basically working on immigration appeals before the circuit courts of the United States. So that I got to write a couple briefs before a couple different circuits, and that was an incredible experience. And then after graduation, I have a clerkship lined up with Judge Edison, who's a magistrate judge in the Southern District of Texas.
So a wealth of experience in the public sector.
Mm-hmm.
And then how about you, Drew?
So I went through OCI 1L year, and I got a summer associate position with Hunt and Andrews Kurth.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent my 1L summer there. I'm split time between doing some corporate work and litigation work. I ended up wanting to do litigation, so I came back this summer again. I was at Hunt and Andrews Kurth, and I did energy litigation and then some bankruptcy adversary proceeding work, and I'll be joining the firm here next fall in the energy litigation group.
Love it. And I'll be at Latham & Watkins doing corporate transactional work afterwards, and that's what I did last summer, and the summer before that I was at Baker Botts. And so been loving the firm life. And now something else I want to ask about, because I think it's kind of interesting, because I feel like both of you— So before I even asked either of you to be on the show, I didn't even like think that both of your spouses are— Drew, by the time this episode posts, you'll be married, so congrats. Shannon will be your spouse. But your spouses are also attorneys, and as is mine. And so would love to hear what your spouses do.
Yeah, so I'll start off. So my husband, Brad, he started his legal career with the Department of Justice and the Executive Office for Immigration Review. So he started as a government attorney, and about half a year ago, he switched over to a mid-sized firm, Wright Close and Barger, which is here in Houston, and he's specializing in appellate practice right now.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my fiance is a transactional attorney with Bracewell. So she mainly does like refinery and power plant type purchase and sale agreements.
Great to know. I think in this small group we have here, we've got people that want to litigate, people that want to transact, people whose spouses litigate or transact, in both the public and private side. And so we'll look to talk about a little of that, and so to kind of let our listeners hear about the different spectrums of legal employment. Before we get into all that, though, I'd love to know what you all would have said you were doing a decade ago. So I think we're all right around the same age, maybe by a year or so. So this would be like freshman, sophomore year of undergrad in college. And so if someone were to ask you then, what would you have said you'd be doing?
So I studied journalism in undergrad, okay. Wanted to be a journalist. My dream job was being an international journalist, so traveling abroad and reporting on international events. So that's where I saw myself, and now I'm in a very different place.
Oh, yeah, I actually remember for 1L year, right?
Yeah.
You were like the pro at like recording like what professors
were
saying and
word
everything.
Word for word. I would get everything down, type very fast. Yeah.
Yeah. So useful
it's
skill.
Come
useful
in handy,
skill.
Yeah.
Right. And how about you, Drew?
You know, I really always wanted to be a lawyer. I think ever since kind of the tail end of high school, I always saw myself as being a lawyer. I just law school sounded intimidating to me, and this, you know, the stakes sounded stressful and a little bit scary. So I worked for 5 years before law school, and finally that itch was still there. And I, you know, I still really wanted to be a lawyer. And so I went back to school.
Yeah. And for me, freshman, sophomore year, I was in ROTC. So like, I knew I was going to the military, and I don't think I had necessarily like any thoughts in my mind that that wasn't what I was going to do. And so I thought like being like a foreign area officer, which is like an army diplomat, was like the coolest job in the world. Hadn't met my wife, Leah, at that point, but when I was in the army, she was in law school, and so kind of got to see like people that she worked with, like when she was interning and everything, and I was like, nah, like that's actually what I want to do. And so ended up leaving the army, and here I am. But I mean, it's an interesting path, I think, and it's a little bit of a long road, but I think it's worth it. I guess we'll see. So awesome. Now that I kind of introduce you all, I'd like to talk about the legal job market on kind of a more broad overview spectrum, because I think a lot of people who go to law school or haven't been to law school yet don't really know like what are the different sorts of job opportunities that you can get going out of law school, or even internships you can get while you're in law school. And so I'd like to break that down into the private sector, which would be law firms, and then the public sector, which would be more working for courts or working for nonprofits or the federal or state government in general. And to start, I know, Drew, you're more in the big law scene. Hunt Andrews Kurth is a big law firm. So I'd love to ask you, what is big law, and what's the difference between a big law firm and a smaller or mid-sized law firm?
So when I think big law, I think of, you know, obviously it has a certain geographic presence and you have to have a certain number of attorneys. But really, I feel like a big law firm kind of does everything. They have all kinds of different practices. They may have a strong area, but they may not have a specialty. And then you have, the resources of having a bunch of offices and maybe having a presence in Asia or Europe. And then like a mid to small size firm is usually going to be targeted at like maybe appellate work or immigration work or personal injury work. And then I think another big difference is that on the big law side, you're mostly representing corporations. And I think when you get into, you know, mid or small law, you're representing a broader array of clients.
Right. Yeah. 100% agree. I think so. Latham & Watkins is also a big law firm. So it's kind of, I also feel like a few things to add might be like big law firms, like you said, like represent corporations. I think also they all pay around the same. And so like there's a certain thing called the cravat scale, even though it's not always cravat that sets the pay. But like all law firms or most big law firms start people at like a similar pay, which it used to be 190,000. Now it's moving to like over 200,000. So like all people are typically compensated somewhere around that amount. And then like a lot of them follow a similar pay structure that goes on from there. And also, but also like with that comes like a higher hourly billing requirement too, which like you might not see that in government jobs. You might not see that in smaller or mid-sized law firms, where a lot of big law firms are asking you to bill 1900 plus hours a year. And that's not like working 1900 plus hours a year. That's like a client is paying for your time 1900 plus hours a year. And so whereas like smaller law firms, they might not require that. Pay could fluctuate. I mean, there are some small or like boutique law firms that pay more than big law firms. And there's plenty that pay less, but they bill less hours. And there's also like people that are very specialized, like what you were alluding to, Drew, you might just be a criminal lawyer and that's all you do. Or you might do simply trust in estates and really focus and specialize on that area of law. I think, you know, kind of looking at where you're at is you may decide what you like one area or the other, or you may get opportunities in one area or the other. But then there's also public opportunities. And so Kirsten, would love to hear from you about those.
Yeah, so I think working in the public sector is a really good option for a lot of students that's just not talked about enough. And part of that is because the big firms have the money to do all the recruiting, come to law schools and talk about opportunities, whereas the nonprofit, state government, the federal government, they just don't have those resources. So I was really happy when you brought me on the podcast to talk about these types of jobs, because I think in the public sector, at least I wanted to go into the public sector because I really value work-life balance. I like the idea of having a job that I can, you know, do it for a set amount of time during the day. Yeah, sure, some days I'll work longer than others. And then I go home and I can really separate myself from the work. And that you can get more easily in the public sector than in the private sector. And also I came into law school wanting to really get meaning out of the work that I was doing. And I just felt that I would be able to do that easier in the public sector if I were working for an organization that I really understood the meaning of and wanted to work toward that. So the federal government is where I would really like to end up in. And there are differences between federal government and state government, obviously, in the hiring and what types of jobs are available. But there's also a lot of overlap. And then nonprofits, too, are a great avenue. In all three of those, you know, you won't see the pay that you will at a typical firm job. With the federal government, at least, the pay is on the, it's called the government scale. So you typically come in at like GS-11, which like the base rate, at least for 2021, was about $55,000. And then okay. It's adjusted by locality. So actually, Houston has one of the highest locality rates, partly nice. Because we have NASA here, okay. And NASA wants to attract people to come work. Right. So the GS-11 base scale right now is 76,000, 74 or 76,000. So that's a significant increase.
Absolutely.
And then you increase from there, maybe like a couple years in, you'll increase to about 105,000. And then with years of service, you'll see those pay bumps too. So, I mean, all of these pay scales are relative, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that is a great salary. But if you come into law school and you need to pay off your loans, you know, you just want to make more money. Like, I get it that a lot of people do want to go do that. But you can still make a good living, you know, working in the federal government.
Right. That's really interesting to hear because, like, I know, like, Houston, the Houston legal market pays similarly to, like, New York and LA and DC, which on the private side, which costs a lot more to live. I mean, it probably double, triple the cost of living. Mm-hmm. And then at least for like housing, whereas it's cool to hear that on the government side, they also still compensate very highly.
Yeah.
So for those of you who don't know where they want to work, you might want to think about Houston. But we'll talk about where to work a little bit later and how to kind of figure that out. I also, Kirsten, was kind of curious, and Drew, I know you have a clerkship, but you're not doing it like post-grad, you're doing it while you're in law school, but I'd love to talk a little bit about clerkship, something I don't really know a lot about, but I know a lot of law students are interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And so would love to know, Kirsten, what is a clerkship?
Yeah, so a clerkship is generally you do a clerkship after graduation. Mm-hmm. You can do judicial internships or externships during law school too, and that might be a good way to determine whether you would want to do a clerkship. Do the same type of work and figure that out. But what a clerkship is, you're working one-on-one with a judge and helping the judge write their opinions, talking through decisions with them, and you're really learning how a judge thinks. And that is really valuable for employers, especially, you know, in the litigation world where you might appear in that judge's courts, because then you have, you just understand how they think and then can, you know, that improves your work product. So it's a really great opportunity and employers really like to see that you have done a clerkship. They're usually 1 or 2 years. I should say most of them are 1 year. And some people jump around from clerkships too. Like I'm doing a magistrate clerkship. I think a lot of people start at district court and then maybe jump to a circuit court if they can do that. Or they just do one clerkship and then go out and practice. But there's a lot of avenues to do it.
Yeah, and I mean, everything I've heard, like, incredible tool for litigators, especially, I think, on the transactional side, you can do it. It's not maybe as valuable just because you're not working with courts or judges nearly as much, but, I mean, still, if you see a lot of contracts, a lot of contract disputes, and your job is to write contracts, like, that can help out a lot. There's definitely some people that do transactional that, like, were clerks and thought it was an awesome experience. So, that's great. I think for our episode today, just so our listeners know, one of the things that we are probably going to focus more on is our own experience, right? Which will be more of probably the bigger law firm side of things, more of the, you know, you working for the federal government and doing a clerkship. And so, but that being said, that experience is going to cover a lot of areas, and a lot of people do these things the same. And I think a lot of the advice and experience that our listeners will get from this episode will help, even if they do want to work for a smaller law firm or they do want to do like a nonprofit. I think a lot of the things that we go over today are going to be helpful. So I just want to kind of note that disclaimer. But that being said, I think this is going to be useful. And so I would say or suggest to you to stay on, even if you do want to do something that none of the three of us are doing. So I want to move on from there and kind of talk about the hiring process, because I think a lot of people don't know, like, how do I apply for one of these jobs? When do I apply? What does that look like? And so we'd love to know from both of you, how did you go about applying for your law job? Maybe, you know, either your internship for last summer or your internship even as a 1L, and what did that look like?
So I can start. So I was pretty intent. I kind of knew, the reason I was going to law school was to try to get a big law job. And so from the jump, I was pretty intent on trying to make that happen. And, you know, it's not easy. It's not the easiest thing in the world to get a 1L summer associate position. But I really hit the ground running. You know, you could apply to firms November 1st of my 1L year. So on November 1st, I sent out everything to every single firm in the Houston area that had
every single firm.
Every single firm. No, I would spend my weekends literally going on every website and every Houston firm, and I had a huge spreadsheet, and I, you know, wrote down whether they offered 1Ls, you know, whether they were diversity positions. I had all the details, when I could apply, what I needed, and I applied everywhere on November 1st, and then I had a couple of phone interviews sort of over like Thanksgiving and even like during finals, before finals really got going. And then after finals, I had a couple of in-person interviews. And nothing came from that. So I applied to OCI, in January. So right after finals. And I interviewed with a couple of firms during OCI, and one of them was Hutton Andrews Kurth, and they, you know, it was a match. We both liked each other. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I can absolutely verify that Drew did have that spreadsheet, because Drew, unlike probably most people, maybe even unlike me, I don't know, like is a really good friend, and actually gave me that spreadsheet. And so and it was very in detail. And honestly, I think it is making some sort of spreadsheet like that is a really easy way to organize a ton of information, because even in the big law sector, like there are a lot of firms do things similarly, mostly because they're competing for similar candidates at similar schools. But even then, like you're going to have different deadlines. You're going to have people that only, you know, accept, like a diversity candidates that are 1Ls versus some people will accept any 1L application or in, you know, even if they do accept diversity candidates, like, do I fit into that? Or do I have the GPA requirement, right, if your grades are out that they're looking for?
There are good, you know, aggregators of information like your career development office,
yep,
or, NALP, North American Legal Placement,
yes,
NALP.com. And they have really good information, but it's not, unfortunately, the best information. So I think I was surprised by how much legwork can even, you know, trying to get the recruiter's name right can sometimes take a long time to try to figure out, you know, if you're going to apply direct.
Right. That's, yeah, that. I 100% agree. I use NALP to find recruiter's names in part. Also, and I'll talk a little bit more in the next section about NALP and about Vault as well, which I also use. And I think for me, I think I actually looked before this episode, and I think I applied to like 21 firms, and pretty much all of them were in the top 20 for Texas. And then from there, I think applying to 20 firms got like 5 callback interviews, and from those 5 callback interviews got offers to all 5 of them. But navigating all that and everything, and then I still did OCI after my first summer, and that's how I ended up at Latham. I actually didn't end up at Latham my first summer, even though I applied to them and ended up, just because of a waiting game, ended up with them my second summer, and that's where I'm going to work. And so definitely a journey. And Kirsten, how about you on your side of things? It's maybe not as structured.
Definitely not as structured. you have to do a lot. There's no OCI for public jobs.
Right.
There just isn't. You might have, like, the Harris County District Attorney's Office shows up at OCI. I don't know if they show up every year, but I've seen them in the past. But for the most part, you're doing a lot of the legwork on your own and just applying straight through the website. And it also happens later in the year than through OCI. You'll usually start applying earliest in January. Typically, applications will open, maybe nonprofits are even later in the semester, later in the spring, which can be anxiety-inducing when you know, all your friends or a lot of your friends are, they have their summer jobs at firms. So that's something you just have to, you know, understand that that's the hiring process and just be okay that, you know, you'll get something. It's just going to take a little longer. So I applied for the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Harris County District Attorney's Office in January, and I had offers from both. But I wanted to, I accepted the U.S. Attorney's Office position because I was more interested in federal work. Also, I'm originally from the Chicago area, and my husband and I might eventually end up back there. And I just think having, going down the federal route, it'll be easier, you know, if we want to up and move back to Chicago. Yeah, it's just a little more flexible to, you know, go from a federal job in Texas to a federal job in Illinois. Right. So that was kind of my thought process there. And then, so I did that internship, loved it. Couldn't go back. They only allow you to go one summer.
Okay.
So I applied to the Department of Justice's Summer Law Intern Program, or commonly known as SLIP. And that is the one paid program through the Department of Justice. It might be one of the only paid internships in the federal government. So yeah, I was really happy to have a little bit of a paycheck last summer. So I applied through that program, and that opens on September 1st, usually, of every year. So that's actually early. And that's a program that you apply for as a rising 2L, or at that point you are a 2L. So you do that the summer before your 3L year. And that sometimes leads into a funnel offer to a position at whatever, you know, area of the department you're in. But it sometimes it doesn't. Like where I was in at the Office of Immigration Litigation, they did not do funnel offers. So if I wanted to work for them, I would have to apply to the Department of Justice's Honors Program, which is a two-year typically a two-year position after you graduate, which can lead into, typically does lead into a permanent position. So that is definitely, in all, in the federal government, that is the way, if you want to work for the federal government right out of law school, you have to apply through these honors programs. Most agencies within the federal government have honors programs. It's not just the Department of Justice. And, that's the way to get hired right off the bat. If you do do a clerkship after graduation, that preserves your eligibility for an honors program. But if you go out and work at a firm, work with a state government, whatever, you cannot then apply to the honors program. So that's just something worth noting. But, you know, you would have experience at that point, so you could just apply straight to whatever agency you want to work for in the federal government. It just wouldn't be through the honors program. So that's a lot of details. But very important to know, because that's one of the things that you wouldn't, the law school or just wouldn't necessarily promote, because...
Well, I was going to ask, did the CDO know that, or did you have to kind of figure out a lot of that info on your own?
If the CDO knew that, they didn't tell me. I think I'm also in the very fortunate position where my husband did do an honors program position through the DOJ, so he had all these deadlines in his mind, and he's been a great guide to me throughout law school. But not everyone has that, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, that person who has been through it before. So
part of the reason we're doing this episode.
Exactly. Like, it's, this is really important. Right. So, you know, listen to this episode, go talk to upperclassmen who, you know, are interested in the public sector, because they know a lot, you know, it's just having gone through the experience. Go to your CDO, because, you know, they might have that information. They're just not sending it out freely, because a lot of students, you know, maybe don't want to go work for the federal government. So the information's out there. You just have to search for it.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying, I feel like a lot of people are going to be like, okay, now at least I know what I don't know, and I can go and ask, like, the right questions or, like, kind of look at, like, even Google search, I'm sure, like, what you're saying, like, these right topics, and kind of search from there. So I think that's great. I know on the private side, like, the CDO was definitely beneficial in at least – like kind of knowing roughly like what is the deadline that like big law firms are going to open up recruiting. Cause I know sometimes the school will limit like when they can recruit or what those deadlines look like and things. So the CDO knew some of that, but I think still like Drew and I both, you know, went out and just kind of searched because each law firm, even if like, I don't know if they play by the rules or not, you know, but like sometimes like some people are just like open an application in November, some are in December, and it would be too cumbersome for a school to like look at every single private law firm in the area and say, hey, like this is everyone's deadlines. Our school does have a website, Simplicity, where you will see job postings that go through that, especially for like a lot of smaller firms. I feel like we'll push like job postings and stuff through that, or even for part-time work. And so I'd imagine most schools have probably some sort of system like that or some sort of website where they can look at those things. So I definitely recommend like checking that out as well. I know I did at one point just to like try to do something else along with the firm I was at, my 1L. But yeah, I think that was good, right? And so you basically you have direct hiring, you have OCI through the school. For those who don't know, the OCI process essentially is a bunch of firms will put themselves on a list, right? And then you'll apply, you'll send out a bunch of application materials, and you'll do like a screener interview, right? And so I think your career development office sets all that up, like your school will set that up. And so I would encourage our listeners to probably direct apply first if you can, right? Like I direct apply to everyone, and then also then went to OCI, like when I did go to OCI. Yep. Like do both. Like unless the firm says like don't apply to us for OCI if you direct applied, like do both. But also, Kirsten, you talked about like a little bit of anxiety in the process, right? And I think one thing that causes a lot of people anxiety is when they do direct apply, like not hearing back. And so I'm curious from you two, how long did it take for you to hear back from firms or from like courts or different departments?
I think it took, I mean,
it's probably gonna be a range too.
It was a range, you know, from like 1 week to 2 or 3 weeks to never. Mm-hmm. It's a funny process. Like, you know, I direct applied to the firm I'm gonna end up at, and they never got back to me.
Yep.
And I was like, well, they didn't say no, so I just applied again through OCI, and things worked out through that channel. You know, until someone says no, you know, I think you have a shot, and you have to keep trying and be persistent.
Absolutely. I think persistence is huge. Like where I'm at, like Latham, like I applied to them, I think November 1st or whenever, like really close to that deadline, didn't hear back until end of January. I'd already accepted an offer to Baker Botts. And so I was just like, hey, sorry. Like, and was really interested in Latham in the application process. And I mean, think of those 20 firms, like maybe 10 of them got back to me at all. And even Baker Botts, like they didn't get back to me. I actually ended up reaching out to them again. Just like when I got my grades in, it's just an update. And I think that's a great tool to use, is when you're direct applying, especially as a 1L, you might not have grades yet. Once you get your grades in, if you like them, or even if you don't, like if you haven't heard back yet, send that as an update and let them know you're still interested. And often, I mean, there are some, like in at least in the Houston office, there's some contingency offers, but I think pretty often people, like firms aren't going to offer you until grades are in anyways. Right. And so stack the slate for yourself, you know, reach out to as many people that you're very interested in and get those interviews lined up so that you have that stuff set up. And then you have more offers to choose from, which is nice. And Kirsten, how about you?
Yeah, so I'll talk specifically about clerkships. So I started applying for clerkships through OSCAR, OSCAR.gov.
Okay.
That's where all the judges, or most of the judges, post their applications for their clerks. And I haven't heard back from any of them. So, you know, they get hundreds of applications. So you will probably never hear unless you get an interview. Mm-hmm. So what I did is I attended there was a judicial meet and greet hosted by the Law Center, and I attended that, and there were a smattering of magistrate judges and district court judges there. And I was put in a group with a few district court judges. And then afterwards, the magistrate judge I'm going to clerk for, Judge Edison, he was there, but I wasn't like put in the breakout room with him. Okay. So I just sent an email to him being like, hey, you know, I was at this meet and greet, would have loved to talk to you, but you know, wasn't placed in your breakout room. What are your clerkship opportunities looking like for 2022? And he emailed me back. Judge Edison is an amazing guy. He very great personality, and he got back to me like within minutes, and he was like, send me your resume. So I did just that, and he, you know, it was a very quick back and forth, and we had an interview set up pretty quick. So, and he ended up hiring me a lot earlier than he usually hires clerks for the following term. So I think that just goes to show, if you do show that initiative and just reach out to people, you know, before the application is posted, before maybe even they're ready, you know, just get on their radar, that, you know, that can work for you.
Absolutely. I think that's like something I know, like for the firm side of things, I know I saw Drew, like you at a lot of like networking events. So firms often are going to host, like, especially pre-COVID, but I'm sure it'll come back to that, you know, eventually, or maybe sooner than later, networking events where, you know, you would go to like a restaurant or something, or maybe like their firm's office, and just have like cocktails and appetizers and just talk to people and get to know people. And I think for me, like I found like those will work out well, or they didn't work out well. I'll tell a story in a little bit about one time that didn't work out well, but those are almost like a screener interview for law firms. OCI like has like official screeners where basically you're going to go and you're going to do like a quick 30-minute interview with two people, and that's like they're a formal screener. But all these networking events are informal screeners, and if you have one attorney or two attorneys, but even all it takes is one attorney to say like, I want, like, we should hire this person, or they're like, I think they're a good candidate. Like, the firm respects other associates and partners' opinions, and like, it's likely, like, it's really not a whole lot of investment for the firm to give a call back a couple hours for a couple people. And so I think you got to take those seriously. And so, curious too, like, so Drew, did you have any sort of like initial screener interviews or like networking events and things that, you know?
Yeah, I had both, but, you know, at some point I think everyone gets a little bit, you're going downtown, you're doing so many of these like receptions, they can get a little bit tedious, and I certainly get that. But so for me, this kind of speaks to the value of these networking events. I, you know, we had OCI with the second or third week of January, and I got home from school one day, like the second week in January, and I had an email from Hunt and Andrews Kerr saying they're doing a reception at a local bar in like an hour.
Yeah.
And I had been to, you know, a million of these receptions over the last month, so many, and they're all fun, but it's just, you know, it's a whole event.
Yeah.
And I convinced myself, I was like, just go put on a suit, you know, no harm, no foul. And I went in there and I just hit it off with the attorneys, and you know, we were talking for like 3 or 4 hours. And then 2 days later, I had my OCI interview with one of the attorneys I met at this networking event. And as I walked in, I already knew I had developed a relationship with this person. They knew me, they knew my background. It was much more informal. And then I never even had a call back after that. It was just from the OCI interview plus the networking opportunity.
That's incredible. Yeah.
And that sealed the deal.
And I think that's huge, really, like that networking part of getting ahead of it, because like firms are going to have like a span of candidates that they're willing to take, right? And like in that span, like there's going to be like the top person in the class, right? Like everyone's going to be like, just based on like their GPA and their rank, like we're going to at least give them a call back and see if we like them, right? But then like as you like get more people recommending you, you're going to increase that span of like your ability to get in there and to get into that firm. Like if you're the bottom of the class, like there's some places that might not take you if they're the best person in the world, right? But like you continue to increase your odds of getting into a place just by like having more people recommend you and say like, this is someone I'd want to work with. And in the end, like law is, it's a people's practice.
Right.
And so it's all about like who you know and who you like to work with. But it, like if you don't know anyone coming in, that does not mean that you're not going to get there. Like I didn't know anyone that worked at Latham at all. Yeah. And that's where I ended up. And so, even though my wife worked at a completely different law firm, like there was no connection there. And it worked out. And I think it worked out by applying and making good impressions. And then on other firms too, like networking really helped out a lot. I'm also curious to talk about callbacks, because I think you said you didn't do it one with Hunt and Andrews Kurth,
right,
Drew, but did you do one with other firms?
Yeah, I did a couple with a bunch of different firms.
And so what do callback interviews look like? And Kirsten, I'm going to wonder what the public side of callbacks looks like too.
Yeah, so I think typically they'll bring you to their office, you know, like 9 or 10, and you'll basically have like 2 or 3 hours of 30-minute interviews with a bunch of different attorneys, typically like two attorneys at a time. And then, you know, you either go to lunch with a couple attorneys or not after.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's like 6 to 8 30-minute interviews. It's a long time to be on. It's a long time to, you know, remember your talking points,
it's
remember your question. It's a marathon. It's a,
and you, yeah. You've actually ran marathons, Drew, so maybe you can attest to that, right?
Yes. It's about the same duration as a marathon. But they're intimidating, and mm-hmm. but I think that there's ways you can make it easier on yourself.
Right.
You know, I really like the mock interviews I did with the career development office. Sometimes yeah. the CEO gets a bad rap. For me, I think I did like 3 mock interviews,
mm-hmm.
and to me, you know, it's like taking a practice test. It was just having that confidence.
Right.
Knowing that all my answers had been really refined, I had my talking points. At the end of the day, I figured out, you know, if I just know these 5 stories that tell kind of who I am and what my, you know, what I can bring mm-hmm. to a firm, you know, I don't really have to worry about anything else. So I really liked the CDO and the mock interviews, and that really prepared me quite well.
I agree 100%. I feel like. Yeah, I did just 1 mock interview, and I remember like there was like something in like my military background, and I went on like a tangent about it, you know? And they were like, hey man, really cool story. Yep. Like, let's cut that down by like a lot. Like, Drew's heard me go on tangents before too, so no one wants to hear that. I didn't know that the interviewers also probably didn't want to hear that, so like I learned that. I learned some of my verbal tics that I could, you know, just kind of refine. But then there were a few verbal tics that they were like, that is a tic, but we actually like it. Like, for 30 minutes, I don't think anyone's going to be upset by that. And they also told me, like, don't wear that tie you were wearing. And so I think there's a segment of this episode where we'll talk a little bit more about those tips and tricks. So I'll save some of those. But also curious, Kirsten, from your side, what are the like callback or whatever the equivalent would be?
Right. I've never, at least so far, really had a callback experience. I think the interview process is typically much quicker and shorter because there's just, I guess, not, they just want to, the government wants to make a decision and get you in there or not.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have had, and I also, it's weird because we've been virtual, right?
Right.
So all of my interviews have been either on Zoom or on the phone. Right. So I had a 15-minute conversation with the U.S. Attorney's Office. I had 30 to 1 hour calls for when I was applying for the DOJ SLIP program. And, you know, that was it. And
right.
then I got offers after that. So definitely a more laid-back experience with my clerkship. I had 1 interview, a Zoom interview with Judge Edison, and that was probably half an hour. With district court judges, I think you might experience a longer interview. But after I did that initial interview with Judge Edison, he also wanted me to talk to his term clerk, who yeah. is there full time. He's been there for years, and his current clerk. So I had a conversation with just the two of them too,
okay.
You know, just so they could
yeah.
feel me out too.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, but that was, you know, half an hour. So
right.
it's really not, at least in my experience so far, not as time consuming as for OCI. But you know, you still have to prepare for it.
Right.
I also did mock interviews. Well, 1 mock interview with the CDO, and that was the toughest interview I've had.
I agree.
Yeah, uh-huh. The longest, toughest, because they ask all the questions
every
that they
question.
Might, you know.
And then
that,
you do your real interview, and everyone like asks your interests, and you're
yeah.
like, yeah, like, I'll talk to you about skiing for like 30 minutes, sure.
Yeah, that was kind of my
yeah.
experience too with the U.S. Attorney's mm-hmm. Office. They, a lot of the time, was talking about my dog and like our dogs, and
right.
you know, I was like, I wasn't prepared for that question, but I could
yeah.
easily
yeah.
talk about my
mm-hmm.
dog. So yeah, you know, I really recommend doing mock interviews before the real thing because it prepares you for everything.
Absolutely. So one other question I want to ask. So I think it's probably it's an easy question. Is like, you know, what would your best experience in legal recruiting be? I think for a lot of us, it's probably like when we got our first offer or when we got the offer for where we're working. I think maybe a more interesting question is, what was your worst moment from legal recruiting? Doesn't have the absolute worst, but one of the worst ones.
I'll take it.
Go ahead.
This isn't terrible. It's just one of those things that everyone tells you to make sure is working before an interview. And you're like, oh, I'd never mess that up. But then I messed it up. So I was going to have one of my interviews for the SLIT program was going to be through Skype.
Okay.
And I haven't used Skype for years. So I downloaded Skype for Business. It's like, okay, I'm ready to go. So the day comes and I click on the Skype link. And it's not working. I cannot get into Skype. So, you know, and I was trying to log in early. So, you know, probably 15 minutes early. And then, you know, 15 minutes comes and goes and I'm not in Skype. So I had emailed them being like, I'm trying, like, you know, something's not working. Uh-huh. And they were trying to help me figure it out. But, you know, it gets to that point where it's just like, well, so they were like, we'll just do a phone interview.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, I blew it. Like, there's no way they're going to make me an offer because, you know, they can't see me. I'm just talking to these, like, a panel of people. It's, you know, kind of awkward. I got an offer still, which was great. So, you know, it didn't completely bomb the experience.
Right.
But, you know, that's one of the things. It's like, oh, Kirsten, you know, you should have made sure. Because the problem was I had downloaded Skype for Business and it was just regular Skype.
Mm-hmm.
So
it still worked out, which is
it
which
worked
is nice.
Out. So my, it's okay.
My experience didn't work out. Mine was I was at a one of the you know, like the wine and dine, like hors d'oeuvre kind of things, and so I made the terrible mistake of drinking red wine, which is not what you should drink. And like I swear there was nothing left in my wine glass, but apparently there was enough that I had just made a slight hand gesture and just spilled it all over my own shirt, and that firm did not call me back or interview me at all, despite following up with them twice. So. And maybe hopefully you can top that, Drew, but I don't know. Let's hear it.
I at one of these receptions, I asked an attorney what year associate he was. He was the hiring partner. You know, I was like, lesson learned. Yeah. Maybe ask a little bit more open-ended questions.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. So that's a bit of the hiring process. But one part of the hiring process we didn't talk about are the actual application materials.
Before we continue, a special thanks to our sponsor, Vinson & Elkins, a global law firm with 11 offices and more than 700 lawyers committed to excellence in serving and advising its sophisticated clients in industries such as energy, finance, technology, real estate, media, and beyond. V&E lawyers are also proud to support pro bono clients across their communities. To help clients navigate complex areas of law, V&E hires the best and brightest law students and lawyers, valuing diverse perspectives and backgrounds. Visit www.velaw.com to learn more about V&E's Summer Associate Program and hiring opportunities. Start your success story at Vinson & Elkins.
So for everything that I've ever had to deal with, you always have a resume that you're giving. You almost always have a cover letter. I've never had anyone not ask for my grades, like an academic transcript. And then sometimes they ask for a writing sample. I think those are probably the big four things that you're often going to see. And feel free to correct me if I'm wrong with any of your experiences. Mm-hmm. But I'd love to talk first about a transcript because I think it's something that probably employers use just to sort candidates at first. So how important are grades in the hiring process?
I would say that they are like 90% of it, 95% of the hiring process. The other things are nice and they're important and they're part of a complete application, but for most of these firms, you need to be at a certain threshold in your class for them to even, you know, interview you, much less offer you. I think that the grades are really important, or much more important if you're straight through, if you didn't work, but I think if you have some work experience, that can sometimes offset some of your grades. But, you know, as much fun as this is, and it is, I used to, you know, on Friday afternoons when I was tired from a long week of law school, I used to just sit there and daydream and go on firm websites and just think about, you know, how life would be in one or two years, my future, right? Which is really fun to do.
Uh-huh.
But your grades are just so important.
Yeah. And the way I've heard it from like a larger firm recruiter, or actually several have kind of told me, like, the process seems to be, they're going to look at like, they're gonna have each school, like each university is gonna have, all law schools have ranks, and so they're gonna look at like each university, and within that school you're gonna have some sort of GPA threshold, and they know what your curve's based on, so it's probably gonna be really kind of correlate with class rank. And so if you go to an Ivy League school, It might not matter what your grades are, you know, depending on the firm, depending on where you're trying to get a job. It might still matter a little bit. I can't really attest to that. I don't go to an Ivy League. But otherwise, like, there's probably going to be some sort of sorting mechanism. Maybe if you're a, 50th ranked law school, if you're in the top 15 or 20% of your class, then you might be able to actually get in, or at least they're going to look at it. I mean, sometimes, like, if you're below a certain threshold, they may not even look at your resume. And that's just the sad truth of it. But they need to sort somehow. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds and thousands of candidates.
And Kevin, a good proxy for that is, you know, even before you even talk to your CDO, you can look at the ABA 509 form for the law school. And you can see how many people at the end of law school are going to a big law or a federal clerkship.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, for example, like U of H has, it's about 200 people in a class, and about 60 to 70 are going to big law or a federal clerkship.
Right.
So you can kind of do the math and say, all right, if I'm in the top 30 or 35%, I have a really good shot at getting big law or a clerkship.
And especially, I think, for Houston and for a lot of schools, it's where you're trying to apply as well can help. So, for instance, in Houston, like, a lot of Houston law firms, because of the school's proximity, like, we're in the city of Houston, you have, like, they're going to have a much maybe broader threshold for, like, Houston candidates. Whereas if you're trying to get a job in Boston or in New York, like, Houston doesn't field a lot of people. There's not those same alumni connections and things. And those firms, you know, maybe if you're number one in your class, you might get away with it, or you have, like, some really strong connection or story to that area. But you may get cycled out just because they simply don't recruit from your school. Again, if you're in a top 10 law school, that might be a different story, but the reality is most people aren't in top 10 law schools. And so looking in that geolocated area can help a lot, especially on the firm side.
So with the public sector, I think, and with nonprofits, grades still matter, but it's not as much emphasis on them. It kind of really depends what you want to do. If you are aiming to work for or go into the honors program in a federal agency, you know, that's one of the things where you really should be in the top 25% of your class at least.
Yeah.
If you want to be competitive for those jobs. And then agencies within and positions within the honors program, some are way more competitive than others. Like, if you want to work in the civil rights division of the DOJ, like, you better be at an Ivy League school and be a really good student at one of those schools, but then others are a little more attainable based on how many positions are open. You know, you can kind of play the numbers game if you really just want an honors program position. I think, and what we might talk about this a bit later, it really helps with the federal government, state government, nonprofits, like, who you know. Obviously, that helps with firms, but I think sometimes, especially with the federal government, a question that I'm asked is, you know, why do you want to work for the federal government? When there are so many students who want to go work at a firm, you know, an easy question is, why do you want to do this?
Yeah.
And if you have a good answer for that and can show, like, demonstrate a commitment to a job in the public service, I think that helps a lot. And then also good writing samples, et cetera, help too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think another thing that helps a lot is having a good resume. And so I'd like to talk about maybe what you all think about what you should have on your resume. Because I think one clear thing, or at least correct me if I'm wrong for your experience, like, it's got to be one page. Like, don't have a resume that's longer than one page. It doesn't matter if you've had a whole life career. I mean, unless your career development office is like, yeah, your life actually was interesting enough to have two pages. Yeah. Like, shy away from that. But that being said, use 0.5 margins. Like, use 6-point spaces. There's a lot of formatting things. The CDO helped me a lot with that. But still, like, content-wise, what do you both think helps a lot to have on there?
So I think that when you're working on your resume, I think you need to remember it has two purposes. The first purpose is to get you in the door. It's a part of your application materials. So it needs to show, you know, it needs to show the best side of you.
Right.
And second is, and almost maybe a little bit more importantly, is it's a conversation piece.
Yep.
You know, when attorneys interview you, they're literally handed your resume as they walk in through the door, or they spent 3 minutes reading it before going into your interview. And so it's really nice to have something on there that can show that you have a little bit of personality, that you want to talk about.
Right.
It's a really good conversation piece. So, for example, mine said, avid Texas barbecue connoisseur. And so then, you know, for some interviews.
What is the best barbecue in Texas?
Pinkerton's.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, or at least in Houston. I mean, maybe other spaces I haven't.
So for some interviews, you know, 20 minutes of a 30-minute interview would be talking about barbecue or college football or running or something like that.
Yeah.
And something where you can kind of relax a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kirsten, I'll chime in too, but I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You've got to have a little like skills and interest line at the bottom. Just a little line, you know, because people go right for that. And I think too, and this is a big thing that how my resume changed from coming into law school and then, you know, how it changed throughout is that I used to have generalized bullet points about what I did in a position.
Yeah.
And I changed those into very specific, like exactly what did I write during my time interning for Judge Rosenthal last semester? You know, what types of things did I work on? Like, you know, a Section 1983 motion to dismiss, you know, really like teasing that out. So, you know, when someone looks at that, it's very clear what you did, not just a very general statement.
I 100% agree. Yeah, I follow, this is probably something from like the military side of things, but like I follow like a STAR format: situation, task, action, result. And so like, say you're going to use three bullets. Like first bullet might be just the situation. Like I was this person in charge of this many people or these certain duties or responsibilities in this organization. And then from there, like I have like maybe two or three bullets below that are like different tasks I had, for me in the military side, like maybe a specific operation I planned for. And then what I did, those actions I took, and then what those results were. And having like, I think, quantified or at least qualified results is so important. Like resulting in like, you know, 99% like efficiency or like an X percent improvement or this many people being taken care of or this many dollars of things being done. Or like you're saying on the legal side, like saying the specific thing that you did. And like, I mean, if you're working for like a firm or somebody like, and it resulted in us winning the case, you know, I mean, that's huge.
I think that's a good point, Kevin, is that you sort of need a results oriented or a quantifiable resume. So like mine had a bullet that said, I had raised X million numbers of dollars. I was in sales before. And you know, you want to show like that you've had success before and you know how to be successful.
Yeah.
And then I think also, I don't know if y'all did this as well, but I had one resume that was for firms that were basically entirely transactional and firms that were basically entirely litigation. I had two completely separate resumes.
Which is fair game.
Yeah.
Fair game. Just don't mix it up when you go in the interview and tell them you want to do one or the other. For me, I knew I wanted to do transaction, but like I think as a first year, you don't really know, right?
Right.
And so for me, like I never was like, I 100,000% want to transact because I really didn't know. That is where I'm at now, but like I was like, I may want to litigate. And so, you know, don't shut the door on opportunities before you know what opportunity you have, because in the end, it's all law. Like it's going to be fairly similar. You're doing similar work. One other thing I want to highlight, I think, Drew, that you said is just how that is. It really is like that few minute thing that they're going to look through or few second thing that somebody was interviewing you. I mean, these are incredibly in any sector. All attorneys are pretty busy. And so they're not going to have a ton of time or they're going to have a lot of applicants. And so like that needs to be something where it's just very easily identifiable. Like, and they're going to, and I would say like, they're probably going to look and say like, okay, school, because they want to know, did you go to the same school as them? Like maybe GPA, maybe it got to them at that point, so they're not worried about that, but they're going to probably look at your activities in law school. Maybe they'll look at undergrad, especially if they went to the same undergrad, but they might just quickly glance the work stuff to see if it's interesting, and they'll probably go to the interests. And so like, again, like really emphasize, like have interests that you're actually interested in and you can talk about. And I think like generic interests, like I like to travel or I like to read, like that's super, super broad. And like, I think most everyone I've met likes to travel. If you're in law school, you at least are very good at reading. That's all you do. Yeah. And so like, I like to read Stephen King novels, you know, at least make it specific or, you know, I want to travel or I've traveled all of Europe. I mean, something like that where people can kind of see that specificity and really get into that, I think is important. I think the other two parts of the application process that we haven't talked about yet are, at least from what I've seen, maybe a little less important, but still probably important to cover. And one of those is the cover letter. And so I'm curious, how unique did you guys make your cover letters, but depending on the job?
Mine were all pretty generic. They were all pretty cookie cutter. it was one of those things like, just try not to talk. Just don't talk your way out of getting in the interview, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I was shocked. My first experience with an interview was like a phone interview, and they mentioned my like cover letter, and they like asked me in-depth questions about it, and I was like, oh, is this gonna be everything? Like, and I had a decent one, right? But like, I was just like, it never again. Yeah. That didn't work out either. Small tip, smile when you're on the phone. They can tell I was way too serious, and yeah. It was like, it came across as way too serious. How about you, Kirsten?
Yeah, I mean, cover letters are the one thing that students really don't like writing, you know, uh-huh. Because it's so easy to make them generic, and then you just think, well, this is pointless. But mm-hmm. I think if you really want a job, much easier to write a cover letter because you actually have reasons why you want that job, and that's right. What you put in the cover letter. I also, if I know the person, like I knew of Judge, mm-hmm. yeah, like mm-hmm. Judge Edison, I put a line in there about how I had seen him in this one context, and I really admired something that he did. So, you know, if you can pick out something, you know, even if they might not know you, but for some reason you know them, like point that out, because they get so many applications from people who really don't know who they are.
Right.
So that's definitely something that should be done. Yeah.
Also wondering on the writing sample side. So I think like, for me personally, like I just took my LSS thing and sent it in, and that was kind of it, right? Like cover letters, like I put some more time into, and if I really like the firm, like you're saying, Kirsten, like I put a lot more time into it. I mean, I had a generic center paragraph, which was like really refined. And then I would have like the above and below paragraphs I would refine depending and how much, you know, if it was for the firm I really wanted to work for, I probably went in there a little bit more. Like for Latham, I think I put some extra time in. But writing samples though, I mean, for me, especially not wanting to litigate, I feel like most people didn't really care. But I mean, any difference in your experiences?
I mean, I think if you want to litigate, like writing samples are really important.
Yeah.
And, you know, it depends what type of job you're applying to,
right.
too. And then you choose the writing sample mm-hmm. to fit that job. You
yeah.
know, if you're applying for some appellate position mm-hmm. and you wrote a brief, whether it was for like if you were in moot court and you wrote a brief for a competition, or maybe you have some prior internship experience with an appellate division, I mean, give them a brief, you know. So try to match the writing sample to what you would do at that position, because they want to see what you can do, how you write. And yes, the writing sample that you turn in might have been edited by your supervisor. Maybe it didn't. Maybe you're turning mm-hmm. in a more rough draft of something, not a rough draft, but you know, not the
yeah.
Published version. But you can just indicate that in the or the cover page to your writing sample, which you should always have to describe it. And you can really use that to tell people like what you did, mm-hmm. how much of the work is yours. Hopefully like a good chunk of it is,
yeah.
You know, and if there was some editing, mention that, but you know, say, you know, the bulk of it is yours, and that's good.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not sure how important the writing sample is. I think that it gets blown out of proportion. I think that it's maybe the third most important piece, but
mm-hmm.
You know, I think that people actually stress about it a little too much relative to other things.
Yeah.
I decided not to include my memo, like the final LSS memo. I just included the email summary of the memo because I thought that would stand out a little bit more,
yeah.
and it was more succinct, and you could actually read that in 2 minutes versus
right.
a memo.
That's cool. I've never heard anyone do that, but I like that. Yeah, I think if you're worrying about your writing sample is the reason you're not applying to a place, submit something. Like, submit whatever you wrote in your 1L legal writing class, and you're good. I think it sounds like the clerkship side is, I mean, it makes sense. Like, judges write
right.
all mm-hmm. the time. Like, they probably care a lot more about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I would assume also like by the time you're applying to clerkships, you've probably written a few things at that point. You have
mm-hmm.
a lot more to choose from,
mm-hmm.
more refined products.
Mm-hmm.
Now we talked about the application materials. We talked about looking for jobs, the legal market, but what about actually interviewing? So I'd like to hear, your tips and tricks for interviewing. So once you have an interview for a particular job, how did you go about preparing for that?
I think it's really important to reach out to someone who is either working
yes.
in a similar position
mm-hmm.
or, you know, previously
yes.
worked at that
yeah.
place. Because
100%.
One, I mean, you get to know from them what the job is like,
right.
You know, so you can more intelligibly talk about it during the interview. But also you can bring up in the interview
mm-hmm.
that you previously talked to this
mm-hmm.
person, which shows the interviewer, you know, that you are really interested. You took
yes.
the time to reach out to them and talk about it. And then they can also go to the person who you talked to. And ask them for further, you know, their opinion about you. So I think that is one of the best things you can do to prep for an interview.
Yeah.
That was going to be my number one piece of advice,
uh-huh.
too, is try to find someone who has worked there or has summered at the firm or wherever and try to get the keys to the castle from them.
Right.
Not only does it show interest, but you'll also be able to ask much more educated questions, you know, and you'll actually be able to know, you know, is this actually more of a transactional officer, litigation officer? Is there some group that they're really proud of that I should try to talk about a lot? And, you know, I would do that. I definitely think mock interviews are a huge, huge benefit. And then I got to the point where I just had like 4 or 5 stories that I felt like I could deploy in any context. Mm-hmm. And I would just, you know, I knew I always had those in my back pocket. So whatever kind of interviewee question, more formal question I would get, I could just pivot to one of those questions or one of those stories without having to stress or, you know, worry about it too much.
And also, Drew, earlier in the episode, you talked about a couple of different websites, Nelp being one of them. I mentioned Vault. For me, like, if I couldn't find somebody I could talk to, I mean, I would try to find someone to talk to, but I would also talk to them or not, go on to Vault and go on to Nelp. I think Vault's really good for law firms because it'll tell you their practice areas and like the ones that are the top ranked in. And almost always, like, if a law firm's like highly ranked in a particular practice area, that means they care about it. And, you know, you might not be able to see, like, it does that particular office do that as much? And I think that's where you need to go to the firm's website, or you need to go to Nelp. And where Nelp can be really useful, at least what I found was really useful, is you can go in and look at, like, what does a firm have, or how many people does a firm have in each practice area?
Right.
So you can look and be like, oh, like, this office, like, litigates more or transacts more, or a lot of firms break it down into, like, energy transactions or, like, the different industries that they do work in. And so I think that's one thing to look at. But also you can see how many law students, or how many 1Ls or 2Ls do they take in for summer classes and per office. And so you can kind of gauge, like, your efforts, right? Because it takes time and you're still trying to get good grades. It takes a lot of time to apply to places. And so if you see that they accept one person, like, and then you see another firm accepts 30 people and they're in the same city, like, I would definitely apply to the 30th one before I apply to the number one. I mean, for the single person hiring. And also as a 1L, some don't accept anyone else at all. Some accept one. Some accept like 6 or 10. And so that can really be an easy way. And I think for me, like, I think the first 10 firms I applied to accepted like more than 2 1Ls in Houston. And that might be different in markets too. I think different markets hire more or less 1Ls. So that's definitely something to ask your CDO about, or just go to Nelp and look it up. But that's absolutely one place that I kind of found that advice.
Yeah, I also think it's really important to prep answers too, and prep answers to easy questions. Mm. Like, you might think that if they ask you, you know, tell me about yourself, like, that's going to be a really easy answer, but it's not. Mm-hmm. Like, my husband would interview prep with me, and he asked me that, like, tell me about yourself. And I was like, oh, okay. So I like started to tell a chronology of my life. I was like, I was born in Illinois, stayed there until 2018 when I moved to Houston with my, and Brad was like, they don't want to know that, you know, they want to know, you know, basics, like a short answer, like have a minute, 45 second response, like, you know, what brought you to law school? Why do you want to work here? Like, have a prepared answer that you can easily spoon feed them.
Right. No, I had the exact same thing, because a lot of people, I mean, you'll see this in a lot of, I think, any job, is they're going to know, like, why do you want to be here, like in this office, especially if you're not from there, like you're talking about being from Illinois, like for me, I was from Massachusetts, and they're like, you know, they'd be like, where are you from, or whatever, tell me, you know, and that comes out, and they're like, well, why do you want to be here? And so, but with that, I also allowed myself to have like a very interesting story about how I got there, and it included like my time in the military, it included meeting my wife, who is also an attorney, so they knew like, okay, he like at least kind of understands what he's getting himself into here, because, you know, sometimes, and especially big law firms, they're like, are they going to want to work all these hours? And, you know, got to kind of talk about those sorts of things and show that like I had really thought about this decision before I ended up there. You know, talked about hating state income tax, and man, that's maybe one of the reasons I wanted to come to Texas. But I agree with you, Kirsten, 100%. Yeah. Prepare. I think prepare a ton. Like for me, you know, for callbacks, especially like law firm callbacks, they often give you like a slate. These are all the attorneys. And I would look them up on LinkedIn, maybe anonymously on a browser that didn't have my own LinkedIn logged in. But I would look them up and I would see like, who are these people? What do we have in common?
Right.
Sometimes like those people would be in, you know, were from Massachusetts, for instance, or went to, you know, I don't think anyone went to my undergrad, but like where, you know, maybe they lived in Killeen, which is where Fort Hood was. And so like, I'll be like, oh, maybe I'll at least mention I'm from Mass. And then we might have a conversation about that. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, find out they're an avid skier and like, I love skiing. And so we can talk about that. Mm-hmm. Like always kind of having those sorts of things, but not feeling forced to use them either. Because sometimes you're going to talk the entire time about something you did not think you were going to talk about. and you might not have prepared for it at all. If the conversation's great, don't force a different conversation.
Right.
Like, roll with it. Mm-hmm. But I think that preparation is absolutely huge.
I think that's a good point, because you never know what you're going to get. You could get, you know, a partner that wants to talk about his practice for 29 of the 30 minutes,
mm-hmm.
or you could get, you know, someone who's been scrambling all day and you're forced to actually lead the conversation.
And not all attorneys are extroverts either. You might get someone super right. introverted.
Yeah. I mean, like, I also memorized a list of like 6 questions that yep. I could ask.
What was like an example question?
I used to, you know, a lot of people ask like, oh, why did you choose this firm? I always find that question kind of canned. So I always said, why did you choose X firm,
mm-hmm.
and what keeps you here?
Yeah.
You know, and if they've been there for 20 or 30 years, that's actually usually a pretty good answer.
Right.
But I mean, I used to, this is embarrassing, but I would figure out where they went to college, and I'd try to, if I didn't know, I'm a big football fan. If I didn't know who their coach was or who their quarterback was when I would go and Google it, just because, you know, on the off chance you need that, it could come in handy.
Prepare. I mean, and this is the law school real talk series. And this is really, I mean, like, and you don't, like, there are some people who are like, just be yourself and just go out there. That might work for some people. I think you should still be yourself.
Yeah.
But the more you prepare, like, the more you have things that you can use, tools at your disposal. Because I think the number one thing of a callback, like, your credentials have passed, right? You're in that sphere. They need to know, if you can't talk to somebody for 30 minutes, how are you going to talk to them and work with them for years and years on end?
Right.
And so if that conversation just dies flat for more than a few seconds, that's a bad sign. And questions, I think, are super crucial. Like, mm-hmm. I know for me, like, and I think questions that show just a little bit of thought, right? You don't have to, like, you know, go into like the firm's financials and just be like, oh, how come you guys got 10% more profitable this year? But like one thing in Latham, like, it was a one firm, like, that's like a big part of Latham is, you know, we don't just have a single headquarters. We don't just follow that. And so, like, asking about that leads into, like, working in her office and, like, you know, different practice areas that we do deals on. And, like, you know, that you can talk a lot about that, but it shows that you've researched the firm, you've researched specifics. I think that's important too. What about you, Kirsten? Do you have a question that you've used or one that you think is a good question or way to come up with them?
The one that Drew mentioned where you asked, like, why have you stayed
at
this place? I like that because you would get a good answer and it's helpful to you, but also people like to talk about themselves. Yeah, so if you're asking your interviewer a question about them, mm-hmm. like, I usually get people smiling when I ask that question, because, you know, they're like, oh, you know, you care about me too. I'll talk about myself now. So that's a really good one. And that just shows that it's not all about you, mm-hmm. you know, you want to know about them too.
Absolutely.
Kirsten, that's a good point. Like, although you are being interviewed, that doesn't mean you need to do all the talking mm-hmm. or you should do all the talking. In fact, I think it means that you want to try to get the attorneys talking more. I mean, people like to hear themselves talk. So the more you can get them talking about themselves, I think, you know, the better it is for you.
Yeah. And it's almost one of those things. It shows confidence, right? Like, you're asking questions about the firm. You're trying to figure out, like, is this a place where I'm going to fit in? Because they want to know that too. Like, everyone wants to know, is this going to be a good fit? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's super important. Now, that's the preparation phase. I think day of, did you guys have any tips or tricks, ways that you set yourself up for success that the day of the interview or during the interview?
I just treated it like any other important day of law mm-hmm. school. Don't do anything new and always get there really early, because parking mm-hmm. anywhere in a new area is always an adventure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily know the situation when you get to wherever you're interviewing. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you have to go into a door, like through a door, and you don't necessarily know what's through that door, I mean, you could easily go through that door and they usher you into the room and it's go time. So, you know, maybe go to the bathroom before you go through that door, or just, like, you know, take stock mm-hmm. of you, like, put on your heels if you have flats on, you know, so that when you're walking through and you're anticipating the first person that's going to see you, whether it's the person interviewing you, whether it's the receptionist or whatever, that you're ready to go, because you know, you don't want to tell, you don't want to hold them up if they're ready to interview you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I would, every interview, get there early, park ahead of time, beeline it to a bathroom, not just to use the bathroom, but also just make sure, like, do I look like good? Like, did my hair get messed up? Is my collar popped or something like that? Mm-hmm. Just like those kind of things that, like, you know, just make you look less prepared, just make a worse impression. Because again, in most instances, you have maybe 30 minutes with someone, often less, like, you're often moving between offices. I think also for me, like you said, Drew, like, I treat it like a final exam. Like, everyone, like, I would sleep beforehand, eat, you know, caffeinate, get myself ready. And also, I think really, truly an important thing is like to smile and like to to try to like relieve some of those nerves. And that's something else I want to talk about is, did you guys get nervous before interviews?
I'm just a nervous person. Definitely. Like you get the butterflies, you feel like you need to throw up maybe, like, you know, but it's all the anticipation for me. Once I'm in a situation and doing it, usually the nervousness subsides. But still, like, you know, you might get chalky mouth in the interview. So bring in a nice looking water bottle with you so that, you know, if you do get chalky mouth, just take a quick sip. But yeah, just know how you are in these types of high stress situations and then, you know, figure out how to deal with that so you can mitigate those nerves or deal with those nerves. Yeah.
That's why I think like preparing is so important, because no matter, you know, you could be as nervous as you can, as you are, but if you've prepared and you know what you're going to talk about or you know what you're going to ask about, I think you just, you can feel much more confident.
I also think you could prepare by doing those networking events that we talked about. Yeah. I think for me, like, the first three or four networking events I went to, no offers, no callbacks, nothing. Like, because I was awful. Like, I was very nervous. Yeah. Like, I would screw something up, you know, that like, or just like, just not leave a good impression. But like after the first couple, like I was performing better. Like I was getting cards.
Right.
People were like hitting me up. I was getting callbacks. And so I think to do as much volume as you can, and there's going to be a ton of opportunities. Your school's likely going to have some sort of table set up where you can go and just introduce yourself to a bunch of people. Maybe don't go to your number one law firm first. Maybe go to a few others and just test it out and get comfortable talking to attorneys. They are people too. And like, they don't bite, but you know, make mistakes and learn from them and correct yourself. I think another thing I learned is how to dress. And so I'm curious, what would you all wear to interviews? Because I remember, or even at like networking events, I remember the first networking event I wore like a polo and everyone was in a full suit because they were all attorneys who came from work, you know?
Yeah. I think for girls at least, like I would not wear this suit to an interview. You know, it's a maroon suit. That's maybe too much of a statement. Like I have a black suit. I have a navy blue suit. I'd choose one.
I would
of those
also not
two.
Wear this suit.
Yeah. So you want to go traditional. You know, some people might advise women to wear skirts. You know, I've never worn a skirt to an interview. You know, I go for the pants, you know? So I don't think you have to do that. Like if you don't like skirts, don't wear a skirt. I don't know. Like if they're going to make you wear a skirt, maybe that's not the right place for you.
Yeah, maybe that's the place you want to work,
right? It's 2021. Yeah, but kind of just tone it down, you know? Don't wear big jewelry. Don't do anything crazy with your hair or your makeup. You know, just kind of go pretty classic.
I would wear the exact same suit that Drew is wearing.
Yeah,
the same brand suit, but just with a blue tie.
I would just wear like a dark suit, white shirt, and then you know, like a light yellow tie or a light red tie. You know, something that's just subtle and you know also shows that you know how to dress to go into the court.
Yep.
But then I think for receptions, I would usually wear just a suit with no tie.
Something more like what I'm wearing now. I've worn this to a reception before. Yeah, and that's fine. Just like. I think when you start to get into like khakis and a polo, like probably you're just gonna feel uncomfortable, even if no one cares.
Yeah.
I think I went to one of my wife's firm's things, and I wore like just like a button down and jeans, and again, everyone's coming from work, they're all wearing suits, and you're just like, this probably wasn't a great call. So I think overdressing a little bit is always appropriate, but you don't have to wear your most conservative thing to like a drinking or hors d'oeuvre kind of appetizer thing, but you should probably too. An interview.
Right.
But after interviews, did you all follow up? Yeah.
I mean, at least the ones that I know I haven't applied to as many places as you, Drew, but you know, I would just shoot an email to whoever I interviewed with, just thanking them for their time.
Yeah.
You know, I've gotten some advice to do a written thank you note and send it in. I've never done that.
Yeah.
I just think it takes too long to get to them. They might make a decision before it even gets
100%.
To them. So just shoot an email. That's how we communicate these days. Yeah.
Yeah. So all the listeners know, from everything I've heard, it's like firms make decisions like often end of the week. And I'm sure on the public side, it sounds like, you know, judges might react very quickly, you know, and they're going to fill their position. And I think maybe after 2 weeks, it's like that decision's probably already been made.
Right. I sent some emails. I didn't send some. I kind of felt it out, and you know, if there was a connection there, or I actually had a real question, I would do that, but most of the follow-up emails were just pretty generic cookie-cutter emails.
I think that's very similar. Like, I would almost always send a follow-up email. I mean, maybe if I didn't connect at all with the person or didn't talk to them for more than a few minutes because something came up, like, yeah, maybe I don't follow up. But almost always, like, the people that took me to lunch, like, thank you so much for lunch. Right. It was great, you know, thanking them for their time. I think if you have some sort of thing you talked about, like, or a question, or you have something you can follow up on, like, I remember one time somebody had, like, a wrist injury, and I had talked about, like, this wrist strap I wore, and I sent them a link, and, like, they remembered that, and they, like, were, like, that they thought it was really cool. And so I think you can follow up in those sorts of ways. And oftentimes, like, if they start, like, contacting you back, like, you're going to get, like, maybe a bit of a feeler, like, oh, maybe they like me. And sometimes they won't, so that's not a red flag, I don't think, either, if they don't say anything. But, yeah. I think we've kind of covered a lot of material. So I want to ask you both one closing question that I'm asking everyone in this series, and that is, if you had one piece of advice to give to a law student, what would it be? I mean, a first-year law student, I guess I should say.
I think I would say stay true to yourself and keep doors open. Mm-hmm. Both of those things are kind of different, because staying true to yourself, you know, I came in wanting to do a job in the public sector. And I had heard, you know, you'll probably change your mind because you'll, you know, everyone's doing firm stuff. You'll, you know, want to make a lot of money. But I just kept, you know, looking for, you know, feeling it out. And I was enjoying my federal experiences. Yeah. So, you know, I'm staying true to that side of me, but I also didn't want to shut doors as I was going through this. So I've still, you know, listened to, like, being a part of this conversation is nice, because I'm hearing all these firm things and I'm talking to friends who have worked at firms. You know, I go to events with my husband at his firm and you talk to them about their job. You know, so I don't tell people I will not work for a firm. Right. You know, you don't want to close doors because you never know what's going to happen.
That's a great point. And both hire. I mean, I know people in big law who work for the federal government and I think people go the opposite way too. I mean, there's a lot of transition and lateraling in the legal market. So I think that's great advice. How about you, Drew?
I would say just, like, be persistent, but also patient. Like, you know, you're not going to hear back from a lot of firms, and that's okay. That's just, you know, there's a lot of people applying, there's a lot of firms. But I also think that if you just keep working on kind of your materials, or you work on your stories and you prepare for your interviews, I think, you know, you'll see fruits from that. And I think just, you know, be patient. For me, like, the third or fourth time I interviewed, I was like, all right, this clicks. I know what I am good at. I feel much more confident now. And enjoy it. It's a fun time.
Yeah, it is fun. I think you ended with time, and that's mine. Time management. I think, like, and it's maybe, like, in the firm and the employment context, it doesn't seem like the most useful, but I actually think it is. I think everything we've said, almost all of this advice takes time, like researching people, writing the right cover letter, making a good resume. All that stuff's going to take time. And when you're a first year law student, especially, like, time is of the essence. You have so much reading, you have finals, you have all these things going on, and you still, like, and we're saying, go to network events, go, you know, like, look up all these people, look up these websites, apply to 20 different places. And that takes a lot of time, even if you do something, you know, fairly generic. And so on our first episode of the series, I talk a little bit more about time management stuff. So check that out. But in short, like, you need to make your life efficient, and you need to do things that are going to make that your life more efficient. Think to yourself, like, if you go to Starbucks every morning and get coffee, nothing against Starbucks, but that's going to take time. And is that, you know, 15 minute each way plus 5 minutes in the drive-thru, 35 minutes? Like, is that 35 minute round trip worth it when you could have applied to a firm and you could make your own coffee at home? And it's just one example. And there's tons of that. So look at your life, look at the time you spend on a lot of things, or even journal it out for a day or two and start to realize, like, what can you do to make your life more time efficient? And it's going to make all of these other pieces of advice so much easier. So with that, I think I'll close out our episode. Thank you so much, Kirsten and Drew, for being on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks for listening. Emphasis Added is a podcast by the Houston Law Review. If you like what you heard, subscribe to us on YouTube or your favorite podcast app, and follow the Houston Law Review on social media or check us out on HoustonLawReview.org. Till next time.